Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello.
Brian Brushwood.
Ahoy, mateys.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, that's me. I'm working the dials.
Are there any actual dials there?
There are there's a good number of them. We don't use them too much. There's mostly like EQ, but it's mostly faders. But people don't know when you say fader, so you got to say dials so that they know what you're talking about.
Fader sounds cooler, though.
It does. It is.
Hey, you know what's cool is waking up on the 4th of July in the morning, just to clarify that, and your whole place is shaking.
Yeah, you guys had some trembler. You guys woke up in a Kevin Bacon movie.
Yes, and I tell my significant other, I'm like, hey, check it out. Like, hey, check it out. It's cool. It's an earthquake, you know, like it's a meteor shower at first. You're like, oh, cool. And then it's like, wow, it's a little bit long here. You know, like, wow, this is going on a little longer. Huh? Yep. That's the longest one I've ever been in LA. And then you go check the news and you're like, yeah, longest earthquake. It's, you know, it struck like 120 miles north of here where it was the most intense. But
how long was it?
You know, it was hard to measure time, you know, when you're in the middle of it. But, you know, I would say it felt like it was going on for like 10 seconds, 15 seconds or something.
Yeah, I saw a clip on Twitter that seemed like it was 10 or 15 seconds. It was it was a thing where they were streaming on Twitch. And so they were like, oh, yeah, a little shake. Oh, it's still going.
Then what happens is they say, hey, you seismologist, like, just so you know, there's a 1 in 20 chance of a bigger one following. It could be the foreshock or the aftershock, like, but it's like, you know, 6%, like 6% or something. It's like, well, obviously that's not going to happen. Next day, guess what? Turns out was no aftershock. That was the foreshock from the day before, and what this was the bigger one. And so I'm sitting in my bed reading my iPad or something like this, and all of a sudden it starts to shake, and you hear, like, we have these the window shades, and because there's something in your house that will move. You know, there's always something that you'll hear moving, and then you start to go tremble back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I'm like, hey, Rosh. And then I hear, you know, she comes running out of the room, the door, like, and we're like, oh, wow, another earthquake, and everything's sort of shaking, and it's shaking longer, and we're kind of counting. I'm like, well, in hurricanes, you get away from windows, but in earthquakes, like, you go towards like a door frame or something that's going to like protect you. And so we go stand by the door frame, and then we hear this sloshing sound, this weird whoosh, 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 whoosh.
Oh, was it the pool? I've seen all the videos of pool water going nuts.
We open up the door, and there's the pool sloshing around and people standing around. I'm like, did somebody jump in there? You know, no, it was just the pool water going splashing up over the, you know, overward, you know, and all the neighbors are there watching. And I'm like, good thing we rent, you know. And
there's actually two videos that kind of illustrate how this looked in real time and also give you a sense of the scope. Bryce, if you can look up the Dodgers.
Yes. Earthquake.
This was during the game.
What I loved, because I watched them first, I saw four or five of the water sloshing videos, and then I came across this video of the Dodgers during the earthquake.
And so, yeah, if you are familiar with, for those of you unfamiliar with American geography, LA and Las Vegas are about, what would you say, four and a half hour drive apart? And so you are going to see this amount of shaking at a Dodger game.
6.4 magnitude the other day. How are they continuing to play baseball? I don't understand how the players can't feel it.
Players feel it. They just know that there's nothing above them that's going to fall on their head.
Well, and also that video, you know, they zoom in so far for that shot that exaggerates the movement because the camera.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. But even then, it's like, you know, that kind of movement in a camera shot would normally come in like as somebody is like jumping on the cameraman during a moment of jubilation. Like that is usually very, very even zoomed in. It takes a lot for that to shake that dramatically. And then, Bryce, if you look up NBA Summer League, this takes place in Vegas, and it's, you know, a similar situation where everything is shaken. Like, it was a pretty intense quake to go from, you know, that region to the other, and also have it be that visible and noticeable.
What it was when I felt the ground beneath me,
correct,
moving left and then right and then left and right, and it wasn't stopping.
I was in Los Angeles for one, Mark, in a home, and the windows started to rattle. And so, correct,
you can see like the trellises shaking above.
You can
see the speakers shaking.
I'm going to say that the difference there is swords of Damocles dangling over you, where you really care about shaking stuff.
There is a lot more hanging from the MGM Garden Arena when this happened, and so they called the game and got all the players off the court. Unlike baseball, where they just played through it.
Murmur and react. You see people immediately heading for the exits. Very calm, very deliberate.
Oh, yeah, they just stop in their tracks.
You can feel it.
Yeah, but that was apparently the thing that they initially pointed out, was that they had the big, which I don't think is quite as solid as they used to be, actual just like bricks that were hoisted to the center. Now a lot of that space in between it is empty, because you can make lighter, thinner panels. But
it'll still kill you when it falls.
It will kill you. Many, many, many deadly projectiles that could kill many people.
Mm. You know, so this is one of those, you know, reminders of, yeah, no, the Earth is below us and has its own plans, and earthquakes can kind of come out of nowhere. And, you know, in California, they talk about, you know, what the big one. And, you know, and the other thing, too, is that you hear a lot about the Yellowstone volcano, but there's like a fault line or whatever there, like a volcano in Yellowstone could be a big deal, too. An earthquake, rather, earthquake going off there. Like, there's a lot of, you know, in the Northeast, there's some faults here. Obviously, California is where we got, you know, the big San Andreas, but, and now the faults have gotten bigger. So, yay, nature.
Oof. I always maintain I would rather be in a hurricane than an earthquake.
And then you move to the Bay Area.
Well, I didn't move there based on weather preferences. I don't know. Like, you have time to worry about a hurricane.
Yeah, hurricane seems like a fairly traditional. Let's use a fully approachable Hearthstone analogy here. Hurricane is like a control player, where it's like, you understand, you're just, you know, you see it coming and you can get ready for it. Whereas like earthquake is full face aggro. I mean, it's just like you don't even know.
Yeah, ready or not, here we come. At least with a hurricane, you can peace. You can leave. Like, you know, you can get out of the way if you want.
We can see hurricanes coming. We have radar technology.
Although, I mean, that being said, hurricanes are also like guessing where it's going to land. Often ends in folly. Like, you drive 5 hours to get away from it, and the next thing you know, you could have stayed exactly where you were. And
see, I think you guys are leaving out the dark horse, real threat. Nothing's worse. Nothing's scarier to me than a tornado.
Like, oh, I'm with you.
Yeah. Because earthquakes, where they tend to happen, you tend to build buildings that are ready to handle an earthquake. And yes, you know, previous disasters like the, you know, San Francisco fires of the early 20th century notwithstanding, in general, they seem to have their act together, right? Hurricanes happen. They occur where hurricanes tend to happen. Freaking tornadoes happen over one third of the center of the United States, and they just land and destroy everything. That's what terrifies me.
Because even the worst damage with a hurricane, like being from Florida and knowing a lot about kind of hurricane damage, we had always understood that New Orleans was going to be screwed if it ever got hit. Like there, that was a problem that had been known for decades before it wreaked, you know, it wreaked the kind of havoc that it wound up doing. There's no stopping a tornado. Tornadoes just, you're going to rip through.
Well, and we got close to, apparently there was a tornado actually touched down briefly in Pound Town. Some people call it Dripping Springs. But there was this moment where
like crazy storm outside, huh? It was a kind of a crazy storm. And then, you know, but meanwhile, it's 11 o'clock at night and I'm in my underwear. And then there's that brief moment that it's like, wow, that's a really intense storm. And you find yourself taking the first step of turning on local television.
Yeah.
and then you see the guy talking and you're like, well, maybe I'll, I mean, I know it's late, but maybe I'll put on pants. I mean, I'll just put on, you know, right. What? Maybe shoes and socks. and then you just start to slowly, your brain is just like, okay, under the stairs, that seems good. Okay. We'll get a couple more minutes, but apparently that touched down and, you know, destroyed a bunch of crap just around the corner from us.
Yeah. And then there's not, you know, there's also the intergalactic disasters and things like that potentially facing us at any moment. You know, you get a rogue solar flare. We don't know how many of those events have happened where it's just, you know, messed up with the upper atmosphere and superheated things for a while and things just baked off.
Man, I really wonder how people will feel. It's so wild because one of those events, let's say it knocked out telecommunications on half the planet for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, right?
We've talked about before in the 19th century, there was a major solar flare event that knocked out telegraph poles and it was significant. And if we had that happen today, it would be very, very, very destructive.
Yeah, catastrophic. But it's interesting because, like, on the one hand, there's part of my brain that wants to say, well, that would be a very boring 4 days that you wouldn't be able to watch Netflix. But then I think after the event, you would hear about the phenomenal death toll of people who weren't able to get their medicine and the people who weren't able to eat and the people who are trapped in elevators or whatever, who died horrifically. And it makes me think about it both in terms of a natural disaster, like would it feel as potent as a 9/11 event if because it happens slowly and because it's difficult to, you know, point to exactly one thing. And then it has me thinking about, you know, cyber warfare. And there's that book, 1 Minute After, that is about what if somebody detonated an EMP with the intention of taking out all the electronics over the United States. I don't know. I hope that I never get to find out any of the questions that I have. But those are the things that run around in my head.
Well, the solar storm of 1859, if that had happened today, you know, we're not just talking disruption. We're talking about satellites getting fried, right? And, you know, satellites, you know, hundreds, thousands of potential satellites getting fried, which would then mean major disruption to telecommunications that could take several years to compensate for. The geopolitical implications of all of a sudden what happens when certain countries and stuff realize, hey, there's no satellites observing these borders. And things like satellites are used for controlling shipping, helping things navigate, and a lot of stuff. You know, we kind of think it's not just we can't get our cable TV, but a lot of things are very, you know, the whole supply chain is very dependent upon that. That would be big if you started taking out, you know, a ton of your power grids, right? Your power lines. If all of a sudden your power grid stuff starts to fail, you have large parts of, forget the developed world for the moment, the undeveloped world, you know, the developed world, you're losing power for months or longer because all of a sudden there's just, you know, there's shortage of all these materials. You think about when we went through hurricanes in Florida, some places took months to get power back, months to get power back in a developed country. A Carrington level event, you could have large parts of the United States spending several years trying to climb back out of that. And we had, like, 7 years ago, there was a coronal mass ejection from the sun that missed us. But had that hit us, that would have been that level.
Yeah, Wikipedia says that the solar storm of 1859 was estimated at $0.6 to $2.6 trillion of damage.
And that's 150 years ago.
They estimate the current cost of a similar event to the U.S. would be that in 2013.
Man, that would be the time to start pirating, right? Like, not in terms of downloading things, but like a real, like, taking over ships pirating, right? Because, like, all communication in shipping freights is all done by satellites.
Yeah, or at the very least, I mean, it's like... suddenly it's the purge because, like, I mean, now we're back to what, testimony? like nobody's got the ability to record anything or know who's going. I mean, I don't know. That's terrifying. That's super scary.
Yeah, and you know, you hope it's one of these things that's overblown. Like, I mean, again, we talk about Y2K being overblown, but damn, people did a lot of preparation to prevent, you know, Y2K from causing more widespread problems and stuff. And that's often one of those, like, oh, we panicked about Y2K. And it's like, yeah, but
well, it's like,
a lot of code.
Depending on how you squint, you could also say, no, we correctly assessed an existential threat and we took action. And you could make a debate about whether or not we overprepared for it, but certainly it made a difference.
Yeah, yeah. Hindsight's a wonderful time to be able to say if you overprepared, you know, or underprepared, you know. And there was an industry that stopped, propped up around sort of scaring people. And now it's the hard part is you get like opportunists come in there to scare people, and you get like, ah, they're just, I'm like, well, yes, I think they are. Doesn't mean there's not a problem. You know, doesn't mean it's not a thing. You know, door to door salesmen used to sell, you know, lightning rods and stuff. And
I believe factually, not one of those houses is less safe for having a lightning rod.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Unless it's like the house where you're like, you know, Damien lived in The Omen, but that's just neither here nor there. That's okay. So sorry. That's what I think of lightning rod.
I'll tell you what else it makes me think of is we just did a series of Modern Rogue episodes where we talked about shortwave radio and that kind of totally decentralized ability to communicate becomes just monstrously valuable in a world where we are increasingly reliant on our cell phones and existing power grids and all that stuff. When the crap hits the fan and when all the electronics get knocked out, you're going to want a shortwave radio.
Oh. Who am I going to talk to?
Well, I mean, you're going to listen. You're going to get the truth. Okay. All of a sudden, facts become a very valuable commodity to know, like, how many days away.
Roger, this is Bacon Eater Burbank. Who's out there? Good looking.
Oh, there's so many jokes that hopefully we'll talk about in the after show. In the meantime, you can get After Things, our after show, if you are a patron at patreon.com/weirdthings. Again, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you not only support this very show, but also you get our After Things podcast, wherein we talk about entrepreneurial skills, what we're working on, projects, real numbers, real issues, all your emails. It comes in the After Things show. And sometimes we talk about shows and movies that we don't want to spoil here on the main show. Maybe there'll be a little bit of discussion about Stranger Things season 3.
You loved it. Yeah, so I bet you loved it because you love the Stranger Things. I bet the things just got stranger.
Yeah, that's the thing is I don't like it when they're just strange. Like Doctor Strange, get out of here.
Yeah.
Not strange enough. I like him. I like him stranger. I like the stranger. You know, that's something that I've enjoyed giving to myself.
Oh, jeez.
Anyway, go Jeez. Ahead on over to patreon.com.
We almost made it.
Hey, we talked about this last week, and now we got some footage that SpaceX was able to recover one of the fairings. The fairing is that big thing that covers the satellite, keeps it from, you know, bugs flying into the, you know, the windshield when they send it up into space. You know, when we went to go visit SpaceX, we saw where they assembled and they have two of these things. They're big enough to hold a bus inside of, and they cost like $3 million a piece. So SpaceX put parachutes on one and was able to capture it. Now we've got the fairing cam where we can actually see video. Do you guys see this?
Yeah, oh my God. It looks like a Pink Floyd concert. Like, I guess it's what, the ionized atmosphere or whatever just glows around it. It's like the end of 2001. You just feel like you're on a trip and become a space baby.
Exactly what's happening.
I mean, look at it. Oh, it's like looking into the face of God, man.
Remember those globes you'd get at Spencer's?
Yes.
It's like being inside a plasma globe. Literally, it's like what it is.
And then there's like sparks dusting off, looking like it's a star field. I mean, it's truly remarkable footage. Oh, yeah.
Like all I can hear is like the lunatic is on the grass.
man, I would love to see the footage like from the perspective of formerly Mr. Steven, now it's what, Ms. Run Around or something?
What?
Ms. Tree is what they
like this footage?
But specifically I want to know what it looks like for the crew to get the projection of where they need to be and hustle over there and all that stuff. Yeah. You know, like I want to see it like a documentary story.
It's a bunch of guys with slide rules, you know.
Slide rules.
Got to keep it old school, man.
Yeah.
It is really amazing footage. And, you know, a question that comes up is like, how come this thing's able to re-enter without heat shields? And the reason is because this thing's so big. It's not going as fast as, I mean, it starts off as fast as, you know, anything else up in space. But once it hits the upper atmosphere, it's got so much more surface area. So it's relative, we'll call it the relative density is less than a capsule, which is smaller, whatever. But because it's like a boat, why a boat floats, you know, you crush that metal hole and it sinks.
Yeah, same reason. Like basically picture a capsule as a bullet entering the atmosphere. This is a feather. And as a result, it hits a much lower terminal velocity.
Yep. So very, very, very cool to watch and to see that, you know, just seeing it from that point of view. And also, one of the things that when they'll talk about, like you watch shows where they talk about in space, when astronauts are reentering the atmosphere, like, oh, we're going to blackout. You know, blackout is when you can't talk to them. And the reason there was a blackout period on most spacecraft was because of that. You know, that plasma, as you saw, it acts as a Faraday cage and blocks all EMF from going to or coming from the capsule. So the space shuttle was different, though, because the space shuttle surface area was so large. It actually had a point at which, like, I think on the rear rudder where they could actually, you know, communicate through.
Do you happen to know why they changed the name of the boat from Mr. Steven to Ms. Tree?
There was a Reddit post on there. I think it might have to do with just, like, if they change ownership or something, because they actually, like, they lease them from somebody.
Okay, got it. So it was a gig, and then they there was a transfer of ownership, and along with that, you had to change the name. Okay.
Yeah, but again, those are owned by somebody else, I believe. A woman's name. I don't know. Woman's touch made it happen.
Do you think they were intentionally going for, like a wink and a nod to Mystery is what they were going for?
In June 2019, Mr. Steven was renamed Mystery after being purchased by Guis Offshore, GO, a company with a longstanding contractual relationship to SpaceX as a provider of variety marine services.
That has to be like a wink to Mystery, right?
Works for me.
Sure. Yeah. I'm in. I like that they're variety ocean services. Like, well we're going to catch your rockets, but also we have juggling.
Water juggling.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just whatever. It's a variety. You know, what do you need?
Also, we're going to retrofit it. It's a glass bottom boat. So we're going to have some customers out from Florida, Boca Raton, on holiday. They're going to see a bunch of octopi really fast as we hurry up and catch a fairing.
Nickel slots, too. Don't forget those.
We're exactly. Multitasking. Right. We're going to get to international waters. We'll conduct a couple of weddings. We're everything. We're everything.
And the world's finest Diana Ross tribute
by George. we have some other news coming out today, which is that SpaceX was able to test their Raptor engine. That's the next generation engine that's going to power the Starship. I guess they ran it for something like 50 seconds, which, remember, you know, a spaceship engine only has to run for a few minutes and it kind of does its job. So they got it up to 50 seconds. Elon Musk says that they had a vibration issue that he think they've solved from a previous test. He says they may be able to do a test later this month and possibly a whole update on the program of building Starship, which, again, is their plan to go to Mars and every place else by the end of this month.
It's so close now, like living my whole life thinking this is all far off future. And you sort of get used to the idea of the future never really comes around. Mm-hmm. An awful lot of the future has happened in the last 10 years, and I'm pretty stoked about it.
Oh, I'm sorry, Brian. I was moving my box with my virtual reality headset out of the way here.
Okay, I'm sorry. I can't hear you. I'm just holding my handheld supercomputer that is a internet-connected global device that I fantasized about my entire life.
Oh, side note. So on the iPhone, have you noticed if you use FaceTime how your face is looking in the right direction?
No.
Oh, yeah. I saw this story. This is crazy.
So
I think this is a new iOS beta or the new iOS 13 feature, right?
Yeah. So remember when I showed you a while back how using the front-facing camera projects those dots and you can move your face back and forth?
Yeah.
Okay. So that, anyhow, that's a fun feature. What it does for our audience out there didn't see it is it basically they create a 3D map of your face. The iPhone, the current iPhones do this. They put the project dots on your face. They make a 3D model of your face and put your face on it. And you can rotate it and look at it. You can stare right at your phone and it's just put your finger on the screen and go sideways. And you're looking at your profile because it's just making a 3D map. So now what using that tech, when you're on FaceTime, instead of you looking off at the camera, they can adjust it to make it look like you're looking at the person there by just changing the point of view slightly.
I think that's awesome, but also we are ceding permission to technology / corporations to fundamentally alter our most intimate moments to tell what some poetic folks would call a greater truth that we're looking into their eyes, but that is in itself a lie. Wow, that's a really complicated thing artistically and aesthetically for me to wrap my mind around. Because
but how much is it already doing that we kind of don't care about? How much is it lightening? How much is it making the image aesthetically pleasing already? At what level is it real?
Well, and it makes me think of the all of those scenes on the bridge of the, you know, the Enterprise, where they play kind of fast and loose, whether or not is this a giant Skype call or is this some kind of, because like they'll do a sideways shot and you'll see someone on the screen in profile looking at Captain Picard or whatever. And then other times you'll look at it and they're staring right down the barrel of the camera. So, I mean, I guess. I was already cool with it on the Enterprise, so I guess I'm with it in real life. But I don't know. That feels fairly remarkable to me.
Oh no, I think it's wild. But you know, already, you know, there are comparisons between different phones because internally, and this is not stuff that you even you really even get access to. But phones treat photos differently. Mm-hmm. They automatically lighten them. They automatically compress them in a certain way, and that's different. You're gonna have two of the same phone with even like some of the same hardware take a picture, and on the OS side they're already altering it. That's something that we've just grown up with. We live with.
And to clarify, like doing things to please you, like evening your skin tones when you see your photo, you don't feel like, oh, I look ugly. Like beautifying, doing things. There's a lot of little subtle things doing there. On our Skype call we're doing right now. They, you know, it started off, of course, like back in the day with like the Bell telephone, like, well, just get rid of the high end frequencies and stuff and used to use voice and slightly less annoying or whatever. And now, you
well,
know,
and like even now, you know, we optimize our color correction to make skin tones look the mm-hmm. best. And as a result, like the three of us on screen look like we have similar skin tones, even though in real life, there we go. It's probably not the case. So I suppose this is just an extension of the same thing. But man, just objectively sort of altering the reality of intimate conversations, I hadn't paused to consider how I feel about that because like all of a sudden there becomes in the battlefield of marketing and position for cell phones. Now all of a sudden there's a new battleground, which is when I talk to somebody on a Samsung phone, I just feel like they're more present and they're more dialed in. It's like, yeah, because we filter out every time your eyes dance away and you're distracted. And we also smooth this out and we also make them look thinner or whatever. Like at what point do we get to a place where we're not comfortable with these little nips and tucks and enhancements?
I think it's when it does something people are very aware of, they're upset with, like we've seen with, you know, social media where things were working the same way for years. And then politically speaking, something happened. People were like, oh my God, there's an outrage. Like you've been asleep, you know? And I think that's, you know, the case here where it'll gradual, you know, you know, we've talked about this before, like even the algorithms used to compress our video and our sound and stuff. You know, we talked about last week, we showed a really cool compression thing that, you know, compresses voice, but some of it, it just regenerates this stuff. Like the pixels you're seeing right now, they're averages, they're approximations, they're guesses. And that gets to be even more extreme. There was an article, it was like 2 weeks ago. Remember the story was like the deep fake with nudes, deep nude or whatever?
Yeah.
It was
this was an app wherein you could take a picture of somebody or submit a picture of a celebrity, as where all the examples were, and it would use a machine learning to basically show you to remove the bikinis or clothing in
celebrity photos of women. Let's be clear, it was
it only worked on women.
Yeah. And at that point, of course, by that point, as Patrick Stewart famously said, "You've seen everything.
It's too late. You've seen everything."
So,
also the other weird thing about that story was that, like, after it was reported, like the guy who made the app was making the rounds. Less than 2 days later, he took it down because he felt so much shame for unleashing that technology on the world.
I think he was also anonymous while it was happening.
Yeah,
that's true. And made his money. He made his.
Yeah,
his
he was selling it for like $99.
Well, and it was like, the funny thing was, is like, you had tech, you know, blogs were covering this and like, for shame, look at this. And we see the Verge thing, like, but let's go ahead and make some artwork to show you what this can do. Because if you're on the fence about buying it, read this article about this horrible thing.
Yeah. And where they also listed the price. Like, it was, it kind of felt like embedded media.
Yeah, it was like, you know, I'm not sure of coverage. Now, we live in this genie's out of the bottle. We've talked about deep fakes before, and some people have said, like, well, we've had Photoshop. Photoshop's required a person to do this. You know, there was no advantage for me to go through Justin's photo feed and Photoshop every image. Not that I haven't thought about that. When I can press a button and I can say, make Justin look stupid doing this or this or this or this, and then send that to all of his friends, and that's done times a billion with everybody. At first, it's going to be outrage, and then we're going to get used to the idea of don't believe anything, but just the scale. We've had manipulation before, but manipulation's always required time and somebody to do this. But when you can take, you know, a video of somebody and press a button and make them nude, or you put their faces into a porn, and there's that moment of, oh my God, we're going to go through this window of like, oh my God, I can't believe this. No, it's fake. No, really. I think it looks so real. And then I think we'll get to the other side of
it. Yeah, I think you're 100% right. I think we're going to get bored with the idea. It's like, yeah, I understand what various types of flesh look like, and whether or not it happens to be accurate or not, at some point we're going to be over the idea of it. Like, I'm thinking about with your Oculus Quest, the idea of how long until there's some real-time version of this where you could just walk around as what in Snow Crash they called a gargoyle, where you just live in a reality where real-time everybody's clothes are digitally removed and you get to walk around in a crazy bunch of naked people
maybe
world.
That's the way I walk around already, Brian.
Look, I mean, we're talking 20 minutes. This is right around the corner. It's got to be, right?
Yeah. Did you see the Mike Tyson's face on the Family Matters intro?
Yeah, not bad. He looks great, like, no matter what body is wearing.
Yeah, it was funny, but I think we're gonna expect more outrage, expect more shock. You know, we're gonna get this, and we're gonna have it's gonna cause problems and stuff because, you know, we have this belief, we want to believe things, and so, you know, you're going to see in politics, you know, you're going to see politically speaking is so good. We're looking at the faces.
To be honest, there's a little part of me that's kind of stoked about the idea that we'll be less obsessed in a world where we can decreasingly trust whether or not somebody actually did or didn't say something 20 years ago. I love that the natural response is, well, let's pay attention to what they're saying today. You know, it's like maybe I did or didn't say that thing 20 years ago. Who could tell? None of us remember. None of us trust computers. How about we listen to the way I feel about things right now?
Yeah, you know, I agree. The thing that's frustrating is, like, I would say there are current events in the political climate where you hear people saying, well, remember when this famous person, everybody knows, said this? And you're like, no, they didn't say that. You know, you took the context of that, but if you listen to the fuller thing, but nobody wants to go back and listen to the other thing because they're totally happy having this belief. And I hope that we, you know, but look, man, you look at, like, videos today of like, oh, look at this 5-second clip. It shows you everything you need to know, and you watch 6 minutes, and you're like, oh no,
The exact opposite. Yeah, I would like to. I mean, look, the weak link in this chain is the humans, and it's the humans that need to change our. We have to, just as this is the libertarian streak of me, just as without making cigarettes illegal, we as a society seem to have lost our taste for cigarettes and in general are giving them up for healthier alternatives. We got to do the same thing for our addiction to outrage. And right now it's not Philip Morris that's doing it. It's your Gizmodos and so on that are benefiting or had been profiting from the outrage engine. But the big thing is not going to come from legislation or regulation. It's going to come from us as a collective set of human beings deciding that we've lost our appetite for instant gratification and for judgment without full context.
Hear, hear, Schwed 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's the thing is we're asking for, we want more filters and gatekeepers. Great. Then you're going to have more filters and gatekeepers, you know? And do you think that will solve the problems? No. Yeah, no, let's be less reactionary.
The more dials and knobs we give ourselves, the more complex, it gets more pervasive of Jack just banned the Nazis. It doesn't get less complex from here. It gets more complex from here the more you put on the platforms to judge what you want. But I don't know. I think that we're getting there a little bit. I do think that there's progress being made culturally. So, we get used to our social media world.
I got a question for you. If Twitter, let's say either a third party with permission from Twitter or Twitter itself, allowed you to alter, like we all agree that Twitter being in charge of curating what we do and don't see, we don't like. That's what we don't like about Facebook. We in general would like to believe that we're hearing the authentic thing. But what if they offered the opportunity for, it's like one day you wake up and you're like, oof, I can't even today. I'm going to enable for today, for this week, for however long, I'm going to turn on blue pill mode, where it's like, I'm just not going to see the stuff that's clearly designed to incite me to outrageous behaviors or unkind words without merit. And let's assume for the sake of this thought experiment, like let's say it's pretty good. Let's say it's pretty much everything that biometrically upon reading you would feel bad about and get yourself in a state over could be filtered out temporarily, and you could switch it on or off. Like, what? Number one, would you try it on for size? Number two, would you feel like that's a good or bad thing to have even available?
I'm all for that, and I mean the problem that we face is that like once people realize that like you can get somebody deplatformed for something you don't agree with by putting a label on them that may or may not fit, and that became weaponized. You know, that was sort of like the social media version of, you know, swatting somebody. People do it all the time, and I would assuming that that were I'm all for that. But the problem is, it's like the goal of some people isn't, oh, protect me from this. It's stop this person from speaking ever.
I mean, but that has its roots in like advertiser boycotts, right? Like the same playbook that is used now on social media is the same thing, and you see it with shows and products and podcasts and everything where you go to the advertisers and do it, because that used to be the way that you could get the attention of the television network or the radio station that the offending parties were on. Now it's you know, a button. You don't even have to go to Charmin and say, hey, you're supporting this. Did you know that blank, blank, blank? Now you can just say flagged, abusive, and for good or ill, something needs to be done with that.
Yeah, I mean, but it comes down to that. Our attitude is like, hey, let individuals sort of decide kind of thing. Like, if you don't like it, ignore it, whatever. But there's the other way of thinking is the fear of like, well, we're capable of understanding what's right or wrong. Other people aren't. And we got to stop this bad information from getting to those other people who aren't these brilliant, critical thinker geniuses like we are. And I think that's the very different attitude. There's that attitude of like, I don't want to keep it not for me, but we've got to stop this from spreading because people will believe this falsehood while, you know, we believe our own falsehoods. And I think that's the big gulf, is that it's just, you know, the one thing thinking, I think everybody should have the opportunity to decide if it's true or false or make up their own opinion. And there's another group that says, no, we've got to keep this from spreading to other people.
You know what I can see happening is on the iOS app, when you are looking at the map of all thing, and to be honest, I think this is a sort of out of step, out of time thing that they have, but there's a little air quality index that tells you how the air is at different places, right? You know, green to red. I could totally see that being a machine learning addition to the Twitterverse, where it's just like, hey, these are the words, but per the settings that you've decided, or I don't know who has control of what part, but there are certain phrases that are designed to initiate outrage and get people to react emotionally.
Isn't that kind of what Facebook is doing with their warnings about stuff?
I don't know. I'm unfamiliar with this.
So Facebook and Instagram have technologies that they're putting in place to battle large-scale misinformation campaigns. Conspiracy theories, anti-vaxxing information, like 9/11 hoaxes and stuff. Like, big things that we all generally kind of consider are not correct, but pervasive information. And so YouTube will do this too, where if you end up on a video about like the moon landing being fake, they will also give you a link this is real information about the moon landing.
Yeah, and it's not just conspiracy stuff. As somebody who has been on YouTube a lot, looking up a lot of historical clips, it is everything. Anything that took place that involves a thing, there is now a Wikipedia citation below it to say, like, let's say you're looking up when the large scale draft went into effect for World War II, and you're trying to find newsreel footage. Totally random example, right? You're going to find the Wikipedia stub before, like, World War II facts below. Like, World War II was a conflict, but it began on this day and that day. So I don't know, man. That's one of those things where I can get it from the platform as to why they're doing it. I made my bones on the Daily Tech News Show of saying that trying to police specifically political speech is a portal to hell. Like, there's no winning that. Like, that will always be something that somebody will be upset about. But I can get the general idea of, like, okay, well, we feel bad if people are believing that 9/11 didn't happen on our platform. And this is the large-scale hub for people finding that out. We would like for that not to be the case. I could see the desire to do something about it, but I don't know. Again, it's like every time that I think we try to put, you know, one more filter, one more barrier in place, I just don't know how effective it is.
Like, there's an article that came out. I don't know much about it, but like the story is like Amazon's removing books on like conversion therapy, you know, which, you know, the idea that, you know, read this book and if you feel gay, you'll be straight, which is, we'll say, probably a very dubious form of bully thing.
That would be a hell of a third act, man. Like, that would be, get out of here, Dan Brown. This is a page turner that'll change your life.
Now, I don't know the full story why this book was pulled or whatever, and I may be extrapolating, but it's like, hey, I still buy a bunch of books on, I don't know, astrology, homeopathy. I mean, my the Echo app has astrology on there, has all this other stuff, and then dangerous stuff like homeopathy and things like this. And I'm like, you know, once you say we're going to stop you from accessing this information,
well, and
I kind of think you got to have a pretty good criteria of how you decide that.
If you want to see what the other side of that looks like, remember that Facebook, before the Boston massacre, the bombing, they were able to hide behind Safe Harbor. They were like, we never do blood and gore. We never do any of that stuff. These are our terms of service. But then after that, people were posting photos, of course, the aftermath. And they were like, well, this is so important, so newsworthy that we have to allow people to post these pictures. And in that moment, they lost their ability to shrug shoulders and say, we're not a publisher. We're just a internet conduit of communication. We don't curate. But at that point, they, by accepting their own rules, they did. And it makes me think, even my own wild hair thought just now about, like, sort of a air quality report tweet by tweet of whether this is highly controversial, whether this is likely decided to or designed to incite outrage or whatever. All of a sudden, I realize that what I'm proposing is to place the Twitter Corporation as the ultimate arbiters of literally what is truth, because at least Wikipedia defines what is truth by, okay, what is the article at which point everybody has pretty much stopped arguing? Whatever that is, where all sides have decided it's not worth their volunteer time to correct every little aspect of it, we can decide that's where truth is at this moment.
But, you know, Wikipedia has its own, you know, bias problems, too. It's like 90% of the writers are male, number one. And you get people who are in charge of, like, this is my fiefdom. I am the arbitrator on this article, and I will say what does or does not go. And you have editors, and there's super controversial stuff on Wikipedia that, like, you know, there are cases of where, like, no, this is factually true, but this writer does not want this thing to be in there and stuff. And I love Wikipedia. I'm not just and I think it's the best example we have of how this can work. And even then, it's just rife with problems. Like, yeah, you know, when you enter in the politics of it.
Well, you know, I was reading a thing by a fairly well-known YouTube creator who was decrying the fact that she had a Wikipedia that was like out and out creepy and out and out. You know, it was like mining her old, you know, public history of stuff to post about her friendships and who she used to talk to and who she doesn't talk to. And it's like that to me is something where that's a concrete example of, yeah, this slides when there's 90% dudes that want to catalog literally everything about this one chick. And she felt like that it had far crossed the line from like, here's a stub where people can understand who I am as a public figure to this is an invasion of privacy and there's no short or easy way for that to go away.
Yeah. One more article. It's kind of cool and scary in the same time, mostly cool, but then a little bit scary. There's a thing called unsupervised machine learning, which is basically give like a big data set and you say you want an outcome. And then the computer system, the machine learning algorithm figures out like they were like cool examples of it. Like, hey, here are like, you know, like four sticks attached to things that move. Can you get from point A to point B? And, you know, after thousands of iterations, this thing learns to walk and builds a walking algorithm better than anything that we thought of. Okay. They've taken a bunch of scientific papers and said, hey, here's a bunch of these, you know, statements about stuff, whatever. Can you start to predict or can you make, you know, inferences upon this? And they're realizing the machine learning is starting to say like, hey, this might be a new discovery. This might be a new chemical combination. This might be a possible area of research, whatever. And it's been very exciting because you're taking this big, huge knowledge of, you know, science and then realizing connections between things we hadn't thought about before. And, you know, give you an example of how something like this works is, you know, Einstein actually, one of the things he, you know, got recognition for is I think he wrote a paper describing like, you know, like, photovoltaics and stuff, like, you know, how photons can knock electrons out of position, whatever, and you can do that. And there was an article, somebody wrote something on like lithography about using, you know, basically how to etch into metal. And 30 years later, you get transistors, you know, and you get CCDs and you get stuff because somebody says, oh, this thing over here and this thing over here. And those two things aren't that connected. But, you know, you make a connection and then you get this amazing piece of technology because buried in papers like, you know, the light bulb, Edison's light bulb using the carbon filament. Somebody else had written about that before, but it was like, man, it's a curiosity. Who would want to use it? Moving right along.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's a particularly good Sam Harris podcast, his Making Sense podcast. He has an expert where they talk about this in the medical field. And of course, the primary example that we point to is the idea that since Watson won Jeopardy, it was going to revolutionize the medical industry or whatever. And it has not turned out that way at all. But along the way, though, there's the real problem that the rapidity with which so many papers are being published, you know, tens of thousands of papers every single year, you can't expect any kind of general practitioner to be keeping up with all of that. And so somebody like, you know, Garry Kasparov is still a big fan of the idea of cyborgs, essentially, humans working together with AIs in order to handle big data sets and figure out connections and stuff. But how long until we realize that why do we still have the human part of everything attached to it? Why don't we just have machines reading all of the articles out there? And then how soon until, why don't we have the machines write the articles, because they'll be better at writing more effective, accurate hashtags to everything, all the tags on it, so that other machines can find it easier.
You know, we're going to see bit by bit, like I know in like radiology right now, that's one of its areas where it's pretty easy to show how the machines are better at diagnosing stuff. And the issue with Watson is extremely capable, but you're trying to apply a lot of things to a field that's very big and extremely conservative. You know, I had to go do like a routine checkup and like, oh, we're going to do these tests on you, whatever. And like, here's your guidelines for this test. Like, do this before four or whatever. And I'm like, I wonder, you know, and I go look up online. I find out like, nope, that's not true. You know, that's no longer considered true. There are these other studies that say, you know, you can have this test done this period, whatever, particularly if you're this age group. And I realize like, yeah, it's like, this is the guideline the doctor's given by the hospital, and this is the thing they've been saying for 20 years, and they're not going to change it anytime soon because nobody's going there and looking at it. You look at like salt guidelines, like, you know, sodium guidelines and stuff like this. A lot of these things we just know are not true at all, but man, does it really hurt? You know, we'll just keep doing it. It's like, well, maybe it does. So it's just a very conservative, slow to change, which is good in some ways.
Well, and certainly it matters when you think of human attention is a finite resource. If you are spending, let's say, 0.5% of your day thinking about your salt intake, and yet biologically you are one of the people for whom sodium levels in no way affects your blood pressure, then those are thought cycles, your most valuable commodity, that are being robbed of you, mm-hmm. or from you.
Yeah. I think that the rate at which machine intelligence accelerating is way faster than human intelligence is. And, you know, somebody pointed out an example, like, here's an example of machines are good and people are good. Like, yeah, 10 years from now, the machines will be good at all of that, you know, in that particular case. And, you know, everybody's hesitant to want to, you know, whatever your field is, you're, you know, particularly doctors, you spend that much time training and doing this, like, you're probably not excited about the idea of having your diagnosis is done from a computer system. But I've had so many bad experiences with bad diagnosis and stuff for things that I live for the day, you know, because I've never had somebody the first time tell me and get it right. It's been the second or third time they figured out how to, you know, treat something from like, God, you know, my chin quiver, whatever, things like this. And it's always been frustrating for me because I hold the profession to high esteem, but I find that many practitioners have it more from an engineering point of view of like, well, look in the book and see what it says here. Well, it doesn't match that. Yeah, but it's the closest to the book thing, you know.
If anybody has seen The Wire, then you understand that incentives are aligned such that you want to give an answer for which you will never get in trouble. Yep. And part of that means whether it's right or it's wrong, whether your gut tells you one thing, whether your brain tells you another thing, you know for a fact that there's no chance you could get sued if you tell them this answer. And that, yep, that affects things.
Incentives are the way to look at everything. They exist in every single system. They're not just a capitalist thing. You can get rid of money and everything and have a purely political system, religious system, or whatever. They exist among monkeys. They have incentives. You know, bacteria respond to incentives. And when you look at the world from that point of view, things make a lot more sense.
Well, and imagine if those get automated, right? Suddenly, do you have a machine that is maybe lighter to diagnose certain conditions because the hospital en masse wants to be more protective against, you know, malpractice suits, you know, is that something that would get better or worse with automation?
Well, that's interesting,
and because administrative control.
Because then they could set that different ways where it's like, mm-hmm. essentially you have different brands of hospital where it's like, hey man, if you want a freewheeling possible 1 in 100 shot of curing your fatal disease overnight or possibly dying from crippling unforeseen circumstances, then go with brand extreme.
Yeah, I mean,
I also think that now you can begin to take some of the diagnosis away from the actors that have the most stake in it. In a world where this is more machine learning, then now you can get second, third, fourth, a thousandth opinions a lot faster.
Yeah, I mean, that's I like the idea of, like, I'm going to go to one place that's just going to give me diagnosis, and I'm going to go somewhere else to get treatment. You know, and we've seen that in systems where, you know, our system, you get insurance companies that, you know, want to stay away from giving you more expensive prescriptions and stuff because it costs money. In single payer systems where they don't spend anywhere near as much on elder care, as far as, like, they don't do hip surgeries on 90-year-olds, and they don't spend much on prenatal, or, you know, they spend on prenatal, but not on, they don't do heart transplants on 5-month-old infants and stuff because the cost to everybody else. And so you can find these trade-offs everywhere, you know? Yeah. And I like the idea of, like, well, I'm going to go over here and get my, I'm going to take it over to this mechanic to tell me what's wrong, but I'm going to go across town to this mechanic to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there should be more blinding. I think everyone should be blind all the time.
Yeah, blind them up.
Blind everybody. Blind everybody.
Right. Blinds are like,
hey, no, it's not blind. Are these picks? These picks, these hot picks. These picks.
Picks! With- all right, we're going to talk about Stranger Things season 3 in the after show, but or on After Things. So I'm going to pick a YouTube series that I got into watching. I don't know if there's any hip-hop fans in the house. But there's a cool little thing that I think is actually interesting. It's called The Cave by the producer Kenny Beats. But it's a little web series where a rapper or rapping group will come in. He's a beat maker and producer. He takes 10 minutes to make a beat, and then they freestyle over it. They're short, fun little videos, and I think it just is such a great way that we're kind of transforming music. It is not the 2005 movie, The Cave.
It's not the horror movie.
Yeah, it is on the Kenny Beats YouTube. But I wound up getting into a rabbit hole with all that, and it was pretty cool. Yeah, the Cave episode 1. He just started uploading them in March, and he does about one a month. But if you like hip hop music, you will enjoy it.
Hey, man. I got into a cave with a bunch of monkeys, specifically night monkeys. Saw the new Spider-Man movie. It was great.
Yeah.
Far From Home. It was great. That opening was great. The scale of everything was great. The cuteness of teenagers who are clearly almost 30 was great. Everything was great. I loved it.
Cool. Bryce?
I just saw on Netflix they got a concert. They got a concert film on Netflix from Japan, but they translated it, which you don't really see a lot with those sorts of concerts. And it was very cool. It was a singer that I've known. She's kind of a legendary singer, but I had never, like, really looked up the lyrics and stuff. So hearing her sing a lot of newer songs. But translated from, and she did the translations herself because she's bilingual. It was really cool. It's called Laughter in the Dark. It's from Utada Hikaru. It's on Netflix now, but it's really cool. It's kind of a sparse sort of concert setup. Is a live band. They do some really cool lighting stuff. They do some video bits, but it's kind of a light touch on all that stuff. It's very cool. I think anybody could really enjoy it.
My pick, which I'm surprised nobody made before, is, oh my God, Spider-Man Far From Home is amazing.
Oh, I'm so glad. What's funny is, like, I felt the absence of any kind of reaction, and I was like, well, maybe I was the only one who liked it this much.
I heard you mumble something muted about a movie, Brian. I wasn't really paying attention because you just had... I don't know. So that's great. I'm like, I don't know what he's talking about because I'm thinking about Spider-Man Far From Home, which was this movie. And yes, they are above high school age, but it's the youngest Spider-Man cast we have ever seen. Andrew Garfield was 30, literally was 30. He did a great job of it when he played a high schooler Peter Parker. You know, Nicholas Hammond was probably like going on 50. I don't know when he did Spider-Man back in the 70s, but I think it's a cast that plays that age pretty well. Great cast. It's I had so much fun, and I don't want to oversell this movie, okay? I'm gonna say, like, not because, oh, it's perfect, but it was so much fun.
Would it be a right way to couch it? In the wake of Avengers Endgame, it was quaint, but something quaint can also be absolutely wonderful.
things you pointed out was like, there's, I'm just going to open, like, it opens up where we get kind of like, what does it feel to be a teenager post the snap?
Yes.
What is it, you know, what is this like? The way they do this was, I was dying, Brian.
Oh my God. That opening was that perfect superposition of like, huh, that's a choice. Okay. And then it's like by the fourth slide, I realized what this had to be and what I was looking at. And I just immediately was just wiggling in my seat. And then I heard and felt my wife start laughing next to me. I mean, it was amazing. It was what a great way to open it.
I thought, like, there have been some, I heard some criticism like, well, they kind of handled the snap, the biggest event that ever happened to humans, in a light way. Like, well, this is 6 months later, and this is a thing, spoiler alert, happens after Endgame. When you haven't seen Endgame, they come back. What I loved was, I thought it dealt with the most realistic view of what it's like to be a person in the Marvel Universe, you know, and the idea that, like, you know, there's like, how the most horrific thing to happen to people, how they handle it. Like, yeah, imagine if one day 9/11 was reversed.
Right.
You know, and imagine we live in a world where 6 months ago, 9/11 got reversed and it got undone.
And that's the key, is that it's 6 months ago, because, yeah, month one, we can't believe it. Yeah. Month two, month three, month four. And then it's 6 months ago, suddenly, you know, you're announcing to your high school class like, yeah, so you guys know this happened. Everyone's back. It's great. Now let's talk about the little things in life.
Yeah, I thought it dealt with that reality for me more so than Endgame. Endgame, we're going to have a therapy group. We're going to talk about this. It's like, okay. I'm going to spoil a little line. Doesn't do anything with the plot, whatever. But one of the kids makes this comment about, like, yeah, and now they teach us about Thor in science class.
Yes.
And you're like, yeah, it's really messed up to be a kid in that world. It's cool because your superheroes are your superstars. They're real. But the other hand, it's like, yeah, I guess we live in a world where aliens are real and gods are real and stuff. You know, like, there's the, you know, the spoiler where the science teacher's theory on everything is witches. Baby's move.
No, it was just delightful. There was a... I'll try to keep it non-spoilery, but if you've read the comics of Spider-Man, then you had an idea who Mysterio was going into it. I saw the movie of the six of us who went, I was the only one who had an expectation of who Mysterio was going in. So as a result, everybody else got one experience that felt like a surprise to them, and I got one moment where I'm like, oh, good, we're past that. Okay, good. All right, now I don't know what's going to happen. And I loved it. It was delightful.
Yeah, and I would say that those of you who are familiar with Mysterio, I would say that you still have there's a slow revelation of other things going on. We'll put it that way. Delightful. I look forward to seeing it again, because I have a feeling looking at it, even in the eyes that I had before, might be a different experience. But
yeah, love it. Can we give a little tip of the hat to the first time J.K. Simmons has showed up in an MCU movie? That when he shows up playing essentially Alex Jones, the character that he was playing.
I was trying to save that from telling Justin that. I didn't want him to know.
It's not a surprise. It's the same character he's doing in the video game. So it's like,
I wanted that.
Which I haven't played.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I had an hour long conversation the other day dancing around because I didn't want to ruin that.
Consider the hat tipped.
Anyway, good movie. I liked it a lot.
Great. It's a minor point, and minor point, but it's it's the end credit thing. So don't worry, it's not a thing in here. Just I'm telling you that. So that's the end credit thing, which is better to know at that than to expect that.
Although I did not see the point of the second end credit thing at all. I didn't
know. Another conversation, Brian.
And we're done. Hey, man. How's it been?
The beauty of this, though, is that I love the fact, one of the things to look forward to 2019 is that we can still, like, you know, spoil our friends' movie, superhero movie going.
I'm blaming myself. The entire weekend I was like, shit, we should go see this movie because I know this is gonna. I'm literally just dreading,
this moment
right now. I knew it was coming. It's the reason why I stayed up way later than I normally do to watch Stranger Things, because I knew I couldn't be screwed on both. I had to know well, at least one from stem to stern.
Yeah, there's so many more surprise Spider-Man Far From Home, rather. It's such a fun movie.
Very fun. Exciting.
Yeah. 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 Okay. All right. It's been spoiling. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.